This is Phil Farron. And I am driving home. Okay, we're trying an experiment today. This is an experiment. I had mentioned last week that I actually recorded this on my phone. And the reason I did that last week is because when I picked up my recorder and turned it on, it wouldn't come on, which was very odd because it's been working fine. And so I thought, well, that's weird. But I thought, well, okay. I'll just record on my phone and I'll be fine, because I thought maybe the recorder had completely gone out at this point. However, I just happened to check, when was it, yesterday or the day before yesterday? I just happened to check. I thought, oh yeah, maybe I'll just replace the batteries on that, because maybe that was the problem. The batteries were bad. That's a possibility. So I flipped on the switch, and the recorder came right up. I mean, it just came right up just like it normally does, and everything was hunky-dory fine, and we were great. And I thought, well, that's very odd. I don't know if I actually checked the recording, but it was up. And I thought, oh, okay, well, maybe we just had a little glitch, something. Maybe the battery wasn't quite seated, because it looked like the batteries were fine. So I put it in my trunk this morning, and then I just pulled it out. I'm just leaving church, finishing up at church. So I pulled it out, got in my car, got ready to start recording, tried to turn it on. Wouldn't turn on again. Now, I should check right now and make sure we're still going. So let me just look here a minute. Yes, we are still going. Yay. Wouldn't turn on again. And then a little whisper said, it's too hot. Which it was warm, because it had been in my trunk all day. And when I looked at the temperature just before I left work, it said 99. So kind of like being in the Philippines again. So I thought, well, okay. So I turned on the car, put it on the coldest setting that I have, held it up in front of the vent for, I don't know, 2-3 minutes. Well, cold air blew on it, turned on just fine. Now that doesn't mean it's gonna stay on. So that's why we're trying an experiment. So we're just gonna see how far we're gonna get through this. I do have the air conditioning on in the car. And I do have it blowing harder than it needs to, because I'm trying to cool down the inside of the car. Hoping that in fact I can make it all the way home before it cuts out. So we'll see how this goes. It is episode 749 today, I believe. Next week 750. And I think what the next boundary for us is 15 years, 15 times 52 would be 750 plus 30, so that would be 780. So we're not quite halfway through the year, but in a couple of weeks here, we'll be halfway through the year, on our way to finishing up 15 years worth of podcasts. So there you go. There you go. All is well. My wife and I continue our little process of evaluating and of looking at where the parameters are for the costumes. It was interesting. I had a really good conversation on Saturday with a friend who is a family counselor, had been in the past, is now a realtor. Good guy. I really enjoy talking to him. And we were talking about this, that, and the other, and we were talking about the costumes, and we were talking about, you know, what had gone on with my wife and with her licensing, and we visiting all of that. And we were, I was talking to him about, I think I've shared it on the podcast, about the domains, about the scoping of these terms that we use, feminine and masculine, and how that the only appropriate scoping for that is biology. You either produce a sperm or an egg, and that's it. There is no other appropriate scoping for that terminology. It is not appropriate to assign feminine and masculine to nouns and gender nouns as we do in many of the Romance language. It's just not appropriate because it doesn't mean anything. And by assigning gender to nouns, what we're really doing is blurring the lines between where the domain, where the scope of these terms should end. And I will pretty much guarantee you it's men who are doing that. Just like men initially have driven the whole transgender movement forward because of their reliance on appearance to determine what is a man and what is a woman, because they want to do that long distance. So we've talked about that. So I was talking to him about all of that. And we got talking, and he was saying, this is one of the interesting things about what you're doing. And I said, yes, very much so. And we talked, and I said, yeah, I agreed with him. And I said, precisely, my whole job, one of my jobs, with the costume is to drive a wedge in between biology and appearance. Because as I am fond of saying, anytime you go beyond biology to define masculine and feminine, you're just selling something. And it may not be immediately apparent what you're selling, but you're selling something. So for instance, if you're going to gender all of your terms in language, what's the point of that? Why do we call a boat a she? I mean, it's not a she. It doesn't produce sperm or egg. But it is a tool. And so by gendering certain things, we represent that this is something that can be used. And it would be really interesting from a usage standpoint to see which nouns are being gendered male and which nouns are being gendered female, and to see if there is an underlying, I haven't done this, if there is an underlying disposition and prejudice to treat those things that are feminine, supposedly, in terms of object, if to see if they are more tool-oriented. Because there would be a reason for that. Because at the base of the male drive is this tendency to treat women as tools to help men control their sperm count. So it would make perfect sense that in the gendering of nouns, what would feel right would be to gender tools of some sort. I haven't looked into that. Maybe I will at some point. I don't know. Anyways, so we were talking about all that, and we were talking about driving this wedge. So as part of what happened with my wife, I just basically told my wife, sweetie, I don't know where the line is here, so whatever you think is great. And what it's come down to is short skirts and high heels. I think I've mentioned that. And so we're doing bodysuits, which is just fine. We're doing International Cat Day tomorrow, and I have a Catwoman outfit that I'm going to wear, but there's a bit that goes along with it, and it's humorous, and it'll be great. You know, we'll have fun. But bodysuits are just fine. So I will have other things coming up that are full bodysuits, because Ned thinks that's just fine. She doesn't have any trouble with them at all. Great. We'll move forward with that. And it achieves, the same type of response that I'm looking for from women, and that is that it amuses them. Women seem to get tickled when they see me in a bodysuit. If they know who I am and if they know what I'm about. So, And I think I've already mentioned, but just in case I hadn't, one of the most amusing things that happened when I was in the rhinestone cowboy suit, which was a bodysuit, hat and gloves and, you know, all covered in rhinestones, was a woman had leaned back and saw me, stopped, kind of leaned back, a younger woman, and she said, okay, I need to know why you're looking so fabulous today. And so I started going through the bit with her and that kind of stuff, and her eyes kept getting bigger. And I didn't understand why her eyes kept getting bigger, like she was like all of a sudden starting to get apprehensive. And in the process of doing that, I thought, oh. And so once I saw that, you know, I just wrapped it up quick and we were done. But once I saw that, I thought, oh, I bet she thought I was gay. And so when she said, tell me why you're so fabulous today, she was expecting to get someone who had a lot of expectations that she would, quote unquote, be safe with, because there would be no way I would be interested in her since I would be gay. And then as I started to talk, she realized, hold it, this guy is not gay. And then that was the confusion. So, anyways, so that was amusing. And it's fine. So we're working on costumes. I did do a little bit of updating to my costume for Catwoman since I had done Catwoman 3 years ago. I've had a special request to bring it back. So that's going to be tomorrow. And then I'm working also on my costume celebrating the 25th anniversary of The Lion King. And then we've got Angel Day coming up. Be an angel. Got an Angel Day coming up. That is always fun. Last year was the first year for that. And so I've got to pull that down from being hung up on chains in my office, where I've got to pull that down and make sure that all the mechanisms are still working, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But we'll do that after this weekend. And so I've got a couple of extra days where I'm going to have a chance to work on the Lion King stuff. And I'm going to try to make something similar to the Broadway musical Mask of Mufasa that they do on Broadway, and this will be fun. It'll be just fun to try. I found a 3D pattern that I could have printed, and I may still could print and then do paper mache over the top of it to get something very similar to the actual mask and then paint that, et cetera, et cetera. But there was just something inside me that kept saying, no, why don't you just make that out of foam? No, why don't you just make that out of foam? And I thought, oh, okay, let's make it out of foam, which is in itself its own interesting challenge because, one moment, let me make it, looks like it's still going, yay! Which in itself was an interesting challenge, because I don't have a 3D pattern for this in foam. Normally when I do something in foam, someone has already done it and they have all the patterns and I just buy the patterns and I have to do the actual physical work of it all. But I don't, you know, I don't have to figure out all the angles and all that kind of stuff. So I'm going to be figuring out all the angles and that's fine. And it'll just be interesting to see how this goes. So should be fun. Should be fun. So that's all well and good. I am on chapter 26 of book 19. No, 27. And I'm in the final chapters and it looks like the book is going to come in just a little bit early. Which is fine. I like it to come in about 140,000-150,000 words. It will probably 145, you know, 149 somewhere there. Probably going to come in at about 140, which is fine. There was first a little, oh, you didn't make it, but it was like, ah, no, it's fine. It's fine. That'll give me a little extra time as I'm editing, which is always good. So that's all fine. One of the interesting things about writing these books is that as I'm projecting forward to the ridiculousness of things, one of the themes in this book, of one of the encounters in this book, and I've mentioned this before, is about bilateral asymmetryism. And bilateral asymmetricalism is really just about this tendency we have to judge people who do not have symmetrical faces. And we change our impressions of people based on what their faces look like, and we do that really, really quickly. And so the book is about that. Well, I came across this article and I thought, oh, here we go again, because I had written in book 15, I had written about a place that had fabric that was the most expensive fabric in the night, and how that they were so proud of it that the king had decreed that all of his upper circle in the royal court, all the women would only be dressed in this fabric, and it was a sheer gauzy fabric, and how that no one should defame or change how the fabric laid and how it did it. And so the women in the upper royal court didn't wear anything on underneath it, and they were basically parading around naked because you could see right through this fabric. And so it was, you know, it was kind of a commentary on some things that had happened theoretically in the royal court during France. There is some question as to just how gauzy the dresses were back then, but there are reports of them being very thin and airy and women not wearing undergarments. So I kind of borrowed that theme. Well, it felt like to me that as soon as I wrote that book about that, that everywhere it seemed like the Hollywood women were all wearing very filmy dresses that you could see right through and see their underwear. They weren't going, although some of them on the top were, they weren't going so far as, you know, not wearing any underwear at all. But, you know, and I think I had mentioned that in earlier podcasts. So now that I've written this book on that has a section in it with facial asymmetry, maybe I'm sensitized to the issue, but I came across this article, and apparently it was written in 2017, so it's not exactly current, but it just popped up on my feed, The Hidden Ways That Faces Shape Politics. So this was written by Zaria Gorvet, I think that's how that's pronounced, on April the 18th, 2017. And Zaria says, a candidate's appearance can influence votes more than you think. So what exactly is a good look for a politician? George Washington knew it. He was particularly conscious of his forehead, which he believed would look better if it was bigger. For maximum emphasis, he pulled his hair back into a tight ponytail and then finished the powerful masculine look with ringlets of curls and a ribbon. Which shows you how much the times have changed. Abraham Lincoln knew it too. The public delighted in mocking his face, which was unusually angular and asymmetrical. Though he's remembered as one of America's greatest presidents at the time, he was deeply unpopular. He was ugly as a scarecrow, they said. He was ungainly and cadaverous, they said. Eventually, even the man who sculpted his likeness at Mount Rushmore joined in, saying that Lincoln's face was primitive and unfurnished. Evidence suggests, I'm going to hop down a little bit here, that the facial appearance of a politician significantly shapes voting decisions. And we often may not even realize what's happening. Drop down a little farther. These judgments are involuntary, unconscious, and happening at frightening speed. Some are made in as little as 33,000ths of a second, which is barely enough time to register what you're looking at. In our studies, people say, this is ridiculous. I barely saw that was a face, said Alexander Todorov, a psychologist at Princeton University and leading expert on the subject. These thin-slice character judgments are based on the slimmest of clues, and yet they have far-reaching implications from where you work to who you marry. Naturally, we expect CEOs and military personnel to look dominant, while those in caring professions should be baby-faced. If you're born with the right aesthetic, you are more likely to be hired in the first place and may find it easier to rise through the ranks. On the other hand, the wrong face, such as one that looks serious if you're dating or stereotypically criminal in court, could blight your romantic prospects or even land you in jail. The effect is so powerful, psychologists have correctly predicted the outcome of elections in the U.S., Bulgaria, France, Austria, Mexico, Finland, and Japan, and the share of votes in the U.S. Senate, House of Representatives, and gubernatorial elections using this characteristic alone. In other words, which of the candidates is prettier? So this idea dates back thousands of years. In ancient times, it was called the art of physiognomy. Physiognomy. The belief that a person's character can be judged by their face. It goes all the way back into the Persians. 18th century, it became a pseudoscience, etc., etc., etc. The bias favors politicians who appear competent, but also reliable, older, attractive, and familiar. In an ideal world, you would randomly assign some candidates to have plastic surgery and go from there, says Lentz. However, a slightly less invasive way to look for clues is to make one artificially. Back in 2010, together with Christopher Olivola from Carnegie Mellon University, Todorov did exactly that. So they took a bunch of pictures, they put them together, saw how close people were to the ideal. It's very interesting. I saw the picture. It's like very interesting how close some of these people are to the average of all that. So anyways, it goes on and on. So Todorov describes first impression of faces as mental shortcuts that help us to make decisions rapidly. The key to fighting back lies in making it easier to learn about the candidates so that voters can replace shallow decisions with rational ones and avoid practices that actively encourage a reliance on snap judgments. Well, that's going to be a thing. Quote, in some countries, they put photographs of the candidates next to their names on the ballot paper, which I would think would encourage snap judgments as opposed to discourage. Limiting the influence of faceism in politics is no easy step, but doing so will be a powerful step towards greater diversity in government and ultimately a more democratic society. Now, that's something George Washington can be proud of, that and his enormous forehead, and that is never going to happen. It will never happen. Because these are the things that we do as human beings. We make these snap judgments. It's just... And this is why when people pick any particular immutable characteristic and then say that they've been oppressed based on that, there are always other characteristics that you can find that you are privileged in. I note, if you will note, I note that all the people who are leaders, who are telling us how oppressed they are and how America's racist and how this and how that, I note that the vast majority of them have symmetrical facial features. They might not be exactly symmetrical, but they're really close. I can't think of any leader that has any kind of real facial deformity, because we won't elect them. And I just wonder sometimes if all this haranguing about, you know, people this, that, and the other, whether it's misogyny, whether it's racism, or it's transphobia, or there's all this kind of stuff, really is just covering up the true prejudice in our world, and that the true prejudice is, in fact, facism, or asymmetricalism, as I call it in the book, or asymist, as I abbreviate it in the book. And the asymists have been in charge for so long. They want to make sure, the conspiracy theory is, that the asymists have been in charge for so long, they want to do everything they can to keep from drawing attention to this. Because they don't want people to see that, in fact, they've got their own privilege that has helped them get jobs and helped them get pay raises, etc., etc., etc. It's all very interesting. They just had an election in the business that I work for. One of the major divisions in there had an election. And prior to the election, I was asked, so who do you think is going to get it? And I named off this person. I said, I really see two potential candidates. And so I named off the two people. And I said, you know, this guy, because he seems to be a mover and a shaker and really good about working the political dynamic. And then I mentioned another guy, and I said, this guy, because he presents really well. He speaks passionately. You know, he is someone who has been involved in missions for a really long time. And he said, I just think in his presentation, it's very good. He's a handsome man. And lo and behold, wouldn't you know it, that's the guy who got voted in. So there you go. There you go. It's all very, very fascinating. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home. And it's still going.